Ben, I think you might need headphones because I get a lot of audio feedback.
Okay, I've got brand new headphones I'm gonna put on. That's like a
Beats by Dre?
Beats by Dre, like but buds.
Rick's gonna start beatboxing now that you got the Beats by Dre headphones.
All right, hold on. Let me see if this is gonna work out.
Nice. Hello and welcome. Happy New Year 2013, the first podcast here of the new year. I'd like to welcome you to Inimate Podcast. I'm Larry Vasquez. Once again, joining me is my cohort in crime here, Rick Arroyo. How you doing, Rick?
Doing great. Happy New Year's to everyone. For those that haven't had the chance to say Happy New Year's, and it's going to be another fun year.
Yeah, we've actually got a good solid lineup for guests for our podcast coming up here for the next couple months here. So I'm already jiving here.
Yeah. I mean, and what I really like about our guests is it's a great mixture. There's something, it's not, you know, the typical, hey, you're going to always hear it from the same type of person, you know, working in the same type of film. So, you know, we try to mix it up, try to bring something original and something new for the audience, and of course entertaining and something to learn from. So
absolutely, yeah, we've got two actually really cool guests tonight that I'm looking forward to talking with. We, you know, we kind of talked about in the past kind of keeping it to one guest per show just so it doesn't get too diluted, where we can kind of concentrate a little bit more. But I thought we there was a nice chemistry with the one that we had with Daryl and Jeff, maybe because they were working together. And so it was kind of definitely a fun show, I thought. So we've got actually two guests tonight here, Ben Willis and Jacob Gardner, who are both DreamWorks animators. Well, let's pull in our guests tonight. How's that sound?
Sounds great.
All right. We appreciate you guys joining us tonight. I know you guys
thanks for having us
and stuff. Yeah. So I appreciate the time.
Of course. Absolutely. It's always fun to do something with Jacob. Jacob and I are cube mates, and it's funny, we have like similarities. Like, we have a lot of similarities, I think, in terms of like taste. But then every once in a while, there's like something that I just completely disagree with him about. So I'll be interested tonight if we're just like all night, we're like, yes, no, I totally agree. Listen, you know.
And then there's that one topic that completely splits us.
Exactly.
That'll throw the show, make it some very interesting, huh?
Yes.
Well, it's kind of funny though, because I was telling Rick at the beginning here, one of the things I wasn't real keen on doing was having multiple guests on, because sometimes for me, I can kind of get a little bit too scattered. But we actually had one show late last year with my brother and one of his coworkers, who's actually a student here at iAnimate as well, Jeff Williams.
Okay.
And it actually made a very, very fun show. And I think it was partly because of the combination of them working together. And so we're looking forward to the same dynamic between you two guys too.
Perfect. We'll try to deliver. We find that on our podcast as well, we like to have multiple guests because it just, you know, feeds the conversation, keeps things going in an entertaining way as opposed to just one person.
And I think what's great for Jacob and I was that we're pretty much doing the same stuff. We couldn't have animated, obviously, the same shots as each other, but we were about as close, same character, same cubes. We shot reference with each other, so it was a lot of same
shots that were back to back.
Yeah,
stuff like that.
Interesting. Yeah. Okay, well, I want to definitely talk about that. For those that are listening here, and we'll get into some of that, you guys were actually on the Jack team for Rise of the Guardians, right?
Correct.
Very cool. So we'll get into some of that. I think it'll be some neat conversation in regards to maybe some of your guys' workflow and stuff. But you guys were talking initially just even about the podcast. You guys both are kind of, what do you want to call it, co-starters of Speaking Animation.
Yes, I guess so. Yeah. Co-founders or whatever. And the podcast site, speakingofanimation.com, where we, myself, Ben, Steve Melagrano, who's another iAnimate instructor, and then also Adam Strick.
Who's over at Blue Sky, right? Blue Sky. Yeah.
Exactly.
I saw on Twitter, what is it, Robot Unicorn or something like that?
that game is awesome.
Well, I just that? Somebody from Blue Sky, but I saw Adam Strick in there, so.
Oh, okay. That's a game that, you know, we would... Occasionally we would, like, you know, you'd be working along and then every once in a while we'll like send each other a new high score or something like that, and then of course everybody stops their work immediately,
tries to beat that.
Tries to beat it. Yeah.
Nice. We'll have to check that one out. What made you guys want to start Speaking of Animation?
Well, we all kind of had online blogs. I think each of us at some point had some kind of animation related blog posting site. And so I think we're all kind of savvy in that sense, or we're, you know, and we had a lot of blogs, like we had a lot of RSS feeds and all that kind of stuff that, or what was it? What is it called? Google Reader, I guess, of tons of blogs and stuff that we would share with each other. And then I think it reached a certain point where we had a lot that we wanted to share or that we wanted to contribute. And I think an inspiration was like the animation podcast, like what Clay Cade has done and what the Spline Doctors did. And we thought that we were in a unique position here at DreamWorks, that there were so many talented artists that worked there that nobody knew about. Like neither of us really knew too many people that worked at DreamWorks. But when we got there, we're like, holy mackerel, so much talent. And we felt like we wanted to expose to the rest of the world, or at least the rest of the animation community, these amazingly talented artists and the stuff that they had to share. And so I know that was a big part of it. How we all got started, but I'm not quite sure. I think we just kind of decided over lunch or...
Yeah, probably. But that's pretty much the root of it, was wanting to share, you know, all these really talented artists with the rest of the internet community, get their names out there.
Well, that was kind of one of the things that when I started kind of proposing this one to Jason and talking with Rick and David Hubert about doing these ones here for iAnimate, that was kind of one of the things I mentioned, was just I love what you guys were doing, and I didn't think you can really have too many podcasts with animators where people just love listening to it. I really love what you guys are doing there. I think one of my favorite ones, though, has to be with the guys from Shrek.
Thorne and Mike Mitchell.
Yeah. That was a really, really funny one. So I really...
There's some crazy characters.
And so, you know, that's kind of some of the stuff that people like myself or the guys from Spine Doctors or something like that might not have a chance to get with them on. So I think it's really cool that you guys are doing there.
I think it was pretty funny, actually, naturally. Yeah, thank you, first of all. And I think it was pretty funny how naturally it just kind of worked out, where it's like Pixar had theirs, like Disney kind of had theirs. And we got one over. Not that necessarily we're trying to be like, well, DreamWorks needs one. But like you said, it's really nice to have all these different artists from across the industry giving input and giving feedback, because it's kind of it's like we're building, we kind of have our own history, and we're actually kind of like cataloging some of this history, which is kind of awesome to be part of. But
the more voices, the better. It's cool.
Yeah.
Just for our listeners here, why don't you really quickly introduce your guys' self so that way they can kind of get your voices as well.
Okay. Why don't you go ahead first, Jacob?
Okay. I am Jacob Gardner. I've been working at DreamWorks for a little over 5 years and teaching at iAnimate since it started.
Awesome.
And you want more than that?
Yeah, yeah. We'll get into some of that here, because I want to find out how, you know, you got into animation and stuff like that.
Okay. Well, and yeah, I guess I'll be terse as well. My name is Benjamin Willis, and I am an animator at DreamWorks as well, and I've been there for almost 7 years, and I taught the first semester of iAnimate, and then since got married and did a whole bunch of other things and got busy, and so I haven't returned. But still very much a supporter of what you guys are doing over there and Jason's efforts. So.
Right on. Jacob, you want to tell us a little bit how you got into animation in the first place and how you scored a sweet job at one of the top studios for animation?
A lot of perseverance and a lot of luck as well. My friends and I at school saw that SIGGRAPH was starting a team-based Iron Animator event in SIGGRAPH 2007. It doesn't exist anymore. It was called Forge or Fjorg, depending on how you pronounce it. There's a J in the middle of it. And so we applied to that just on a whim, and we happened to get accepted to be one of the teams to do it. And then, lucky enough, we were actually chosen as the winning team. And because of that, we got a tour of DreamWorks and got to have dinner with a couple of the heads of character animation at the time. And from that, they offered me a job, and it was awesome.
Right on.
It was a lot of luck and right place, right time, and plenty of perseverance as well, like I said.
Sweet.
I mean, Jacob is very humble, but he worked his butt off to get to where he was. You know, there's no, there wasn't a whole, he made a lot of his luck. So while luck is obviously, you know, a factor, you know, and timing and all that kind of stuff, you know, he definitely, that's something that I admire about him is how he worked his hardest to make himself as lucky as possible.
Right.
Thank you, Ben.
Right timing and right place doesn't do a whole lot of good if you don't have a good demo, huh?
Right. Yeah. If you're not ready for it, if you're not ready to go, you know, they can pass you by.
Thanks, guys.
What about you, Ben?
Well, I I don't necessarily want to come across cocky or anything, but my path wasn't all that long. I didn't have to go pay my dues too much. After school, I met with an alumni. I went to Savannah College of Art and Design, and I had met with an alumni there when I was graduating, and he offered me a position to work on a short film that his company, Charlex, up in New York City, was working on. Sorry, it's not his company. He was the vice president, but I mean, he was very much in charge of it. And at first, I said no because I was applying to a bunch of big studios just to see. Because you got to try for your dream. So I'm like, you know, I'm going to send out those reels, because I figured I would feel worse if I accepted the job at Charlex. Not that it's a bad company, but if I accepted the job there and then some other company said, hey, we want you, I'd be like, ah, I can't because I'm over here. So I'm like, I might as well just say no and then just see how it works out. And so pretty much either they sent me a different company, sent me rejection letters, or they didn't say anything at all. So I ended up going to Charlex. And I was there for about 8 months, 8 or 9 months, working on a short film called One Rat Short, which won Best in Show at SIGGRAPH, I think 2006. And then I really didn't like working there anymore. And it was the end of my contract, and I was like, I'm going to go. So they're like, cool. So I went back home in New Hampshire for about 2 months, and I worked on my reel. And I had this mentor, Stephen Gregory. He used to work at Pixar. I think he's at Double Fine. And he kind of helped critique my work. And then we added some pieces to my reel that I thought were missing. And then I applied to a few more studios. And there was actually a friend who I had met at Charlex who used to work at DreamWorks. And he's like, hey, I'll forward your reel on. So he did. And then like a month later, I got a call back from DreamWorks. And then they set up a video conference interview. And then, yeah, I guess the rest is history from there.
For both of you guys, what movies you have under your belt right now?
Why don't you go first, Jake?
I was a background in Cycles animator on Monsters vs. Aliens. And after that, I was promoted to a normal shot animator for Shrek Forever After, Megamind, Puss in Boots, Rise of the Guardians, a little bit on Madagascar 3, and a couple of the short film DVD stuff in between there.
Okay.
When I started at DreamWorks, I started on Kung Fu Panda, the first one, and I worked on a little bit of Madagascar 2, obviously Shrek Forever After as well. I worked on Kung Fu Panda 2. I worked on the Kung Fu Panda Holiday Special, obviously Rise of the Guardians.
Yeah.
Puss in Boots for a couple months. I think that's it. I'm probably leaving one out or something like that.
I left one out. I left out Croods that I just finished.
Croods that you just finished on.
Croods. Yeah.
It's just it's hard sometimes because and I'm currently on Me and My Shadow, so that will count eventually. But and I worked on How to Train Your Dragon, the old version before. Well, the trouble is that like sometimes like it's nice to be on a film from earlier on, but sometimes you get when you're in between projects. Like after I finished Panda, they tossed me onto Madagascar 2, and then onto Some of Dragons, and then back onto Mad 2, and then back onto Dragons, and then over to Shrek, and then sometimes it's like you only work for a short period of time on.
And then you and Shrek just kind of clicked, so they kept you there.
Yeah.
Now Shrek 4 seemed like that was one where Jason kind of made a lot of his decisions based upon who he was going to pull from for his instructors here at IIM. And I think that's fantastic. I thought it was a great show. It was definitely maybe if Shrek 3 hadn't,
We can talk about it. We can be real.
Yeah.
We can be real.
Yeah, let's just throw it out there.
If Shrek 3 hadn't been there, Shrek 4 would have been much better. But I thought it was a really, really good film. It was a lot of heart, particularly for a Shrek film, but some really juicy acting shots in there. And I know that's one of the things that Jason kind of pulled a lot of you guys from there because it was a tight-knit group. It wasn't just, hey, these guys are good animators. He'd worked with you guys. He knew you guys as far as be able to be good instructors as well.
Awesome. Go ahead, Ben.
Well, I was going to say that this is what we hoped wouldn't happen. I'm just kidding. No, I think on Shrek, it was obviously working on the film. Mike Mitchell, the director, was a huge part of what made that project so much fun and to work on. And he really allowed us to bring what we could to the table, bring our own ideas. I mean, he had a great idea of like what was funny. So he'd make sure that we got the point of the shot and that, it was like at least some kind of funny idea for it. Definitely working with Jason and such, I think he also gave us a lot of that freedom. So I think what was great about it is that we really got to shine through, for better or worse. We got to, our sensibilities and our choices and creativity really got to shine through a little bit more maybe on that show than maybe on others.
Now, is that kind of unique? Because I know one of the things that Jason's mentioned at times is that, particularly as students, it's a lot of fun now because you're getting to work on your own shots versus when you get into a studio, you're working on someone else's work. So is that a pretty unique opportunity, as you're mentioning here with Shrek 4?
Yeah, I think with Shrek 4, I mean, you always have to, you're still making the director's movie, so you always have, you're trying to fulfill the story and you're trying to stick to the character and you're trying your best not to be too different or stick out too much from everybody else's shots. But some movies you have a little bit more leeway than others, and as I recall, Shrek 4, at least for me, was one where I could stretch a little bit, I could express a little bit more.
Yeah, Mike Mitchell was awesome with really wanting people to bring themselves to every shot that they did and make sure that they really had a voice in what was going to happen in there. And he was so enthused to see everybody's ideas at dailies every day, which is really refreshing because it's not always like that. So it was a really fun project.
I liked Megamind a lot. Now, I know you got to work on him as well, right, Jacob?
Yeah. I had a lot of fun on Megamind. I feel like I made a really big stride on Megamind. I was finding my way as a fresh animator on Shrek 4, and then I think I kind of found some groove in there on Megamind, and yeah, it was a lot of fun.
Now, how big is that? Because having taken some classes here at iAnimate and still learning as a student, those are just some of those neat moments where you kind of feel like you're making those strides there. And it's like, obviously, you're working at one of the largest studios for animation. You're still doing that, though, right?
Making
those strides and kind of growing as an artist.
Absolutely. You're constantly, trying to better yourself. And if it sucks, but every once in a while you feel like you've plateaued for a little bit and you need something to kick you into gear and, freshen things up a little bit. But on Megamind, I felt like I was making big strides and other people were noticing as well. So they started trusting me more and the Supes were giving me better work. And then that just propelled me further. And so it was kind of like this upward cycle that helped a lot on that movie. And it's not always that way.
What was it that you felt like kind of helped you get those strides or kind of get over those hurdles?
Guidance from the people above me and listening to their opinions and trying to put my own thing in and then let them help me make it better.
Yeah.
And I always really appreciate the supervisors that will, or instructors that will take your idea and try and make it as good as it can be instead of make it a different idea or make it their idea or something. People were doing that for me.
Yeah.
On Megamind a lot, and that helped a lot. And then also just, that feeling of trust boosts your self-confidence, not to a point of arrogance, but to a point where you can start being comfortable with your decisions and, actually putting stuff in there sooner and showing it sooner and stuff like that. And it just all kind of works together to build up.
I think a lot of that as well is that Jacob – is that so much of it is rests on you as well to push for that. Even if you are plateauing and that sort of thing, that you still have to push to be, I want to be better. I want to get better at this. I want to keep going at it because there are many people that you see, and I hate to say it, a lot of older animators that you see that maybe have gotten a little bit more tired or maybe it's a little bit more of a job for them and they don't necessarily push as much as they used to. And that's something that I know, at least for Jacob and myself, but that's something that keeps us interested in our job and fulfilled in our job is that, we're not just trying to go through our job, make money, animate, do something that we love, but we also want to get better at what we're doing and we want to continue to, because there's always more to be done. You could always have a better performance or I feel like my understanding of animation has like evolved over the years and it just kind of continues to evolve to what you think is most important. And for me, like honestly, if I wasn't pushing, my animation for trying to get better or seeking out people like Jacob was saying with supervisors and that sort of thing, seeking people that could give you that help to that next level or help you get a better eye, then as far as I'm concerned, I don't know if I would necessarily continue to be an animator after like X amount of years. After a while I'd be like, okay, I might as well go
try something new.
Yeah. Try something new. Why not? Go try something and see if I can get better at that. Whereas with animation, there's a lot of personal decision that needs to come in where you need to continue to strive to be better or want to be better.
No, that's very cool. I come from a wrestling background, so, that same mentality, and that's why I love hearing about this, is that idea that you're never satisfied with what you achieve. It's that constant trying to progress and learn and never just being settled there.
Yeah, I think it's also good for being humble as well, to help keep a certain humility as well. You know, because like what Jacob was saying, with that, people started to notice that he was getting better. You know, he was starting to do better shots and better work. And that just literally comes out of his own desire to get better at what he does and to get a better performance. And then all the rest of the good stuff comes with it, you know, the accolades and all that other kind of stuff, or better shots. You know, you get cast better shots and that sort of thing. But always focusing on your work and trying to get it better and trying to learn better forces you to be more humble. It forces you to ask others, you know, you're doing this really well. How are you doing that? Or show me what I can do better, you know, and I think that is healthy as well.
Yeah. We used to have on the website when you first log in, it would say, leave all egos at the door, you know?
Yeah.
Absolutely. I feel like if you're not looking back at your work from, oh, let's say 2 months ago or further, and cringing, then you're probably in the wrong mindset. I really love it. What's a double-edged sword? Because you think, oh, great, this is what I have to show for myself. But then also you're thinking, that just means that currently I'm better than I was, you know, a month ago. Yeah. So let's show it. Let's, you know, push it further.
How do you let go of a shot? Feeling like, okay, this is...
It's said that you never do.
Yeah. What is it? They're never done? You just...
You surrender.
That's nice.
There's always more things you wish you could do, but with, I don't know, time constraints, and it has to get out on the release date. You have to move on to the next shot.
Is there any shot in particular that comes to mind for each one of you guys that you go, oh, I would, if I had the chance to tackle that one again, even if it was on my own time, just to finish, you know, to do what I want to do with it.
Do you mean from scratch again, or
just, it's whatever. If you felt like, hey, if I can add some more time, or if I could have done that one shot over, or whatever it would have been, is there one that comes to mind that's particular for you guys that?
There is. I mean, what I will say is that I do make sure that I am at peace when I let it go. I mean, there's only so much you can do, but you have to be at peace. If the director says final and you've got no more time on it, at a certain point, you're like, okay. Good. You know, it goes out. I'm not going to, you know. And what's funny is that Jacob and I actually, I think we're talking about this earlier where, crap, what were we talking about earlier today? It was something along the lines of, you know, because we got this new software, and so you can always develop stuff and you can always keep changing and doing new iterations and that kind of stuff. And actually, it's kind of a blessing sometimes that you have a time constraint and that you have to make decisions and be definitive with it. Because honestly, I think I could go back to a bunch of my shots, and I don't know if I could necessarily make them better, you know? They might be different, or I might actually water them down. But since you did mention there's, I think, one shot from Shrek at least, or a couple of shots from Shrek that I would like back.
Yeah, there's plenty that I wish I could do a little bit more polish here or there, but most of the time it's that I wish I could start over. Because I feel like I've grown so much that my acting choices would be way different now than they would have been when I originally did the shot.
Yeah. Because there's just, even as a student, because it's like you're saying, you're always growing. So it's one of those things. It's like, you kind of feel like, oh, I could, now if I can just get my hands on that one shot, I could do so much different with it or better.
Right. Although, since we don't have the opportunity to go back, I also want to make it clear that students shouldn't do that either. Because if you just spin your wheels on the same shot and always try to change things, you're not really progressing. You have to put it away and start a new one. And that's what makes you progress, is actually, you know, going through that whole iterative process again.
Yeah. Nice.
Okay. I kind of second that as well. Like, just even just for the sheer idea that you've accomplished something, you know, even though it wasn't as successful as you had hoped, you accomplished something, you finished it, you put that aside, I learned, let's just move forward and just continue moving forward, you know, doing new things and learning.
What were some of your guys' favorite characters that you've worked on so far?
Jack Frost.
Yeah.
Maybe because it's most recent, but I really enjoyed that process. That was a lot of fun.
I don't know how much I would say I enjoyed Jack Frost. I mean, after
it was a love-hate relationship.
It was love-hate,
sure.
I got to tell you guys up front, though, I really, really liked the movie.
Awesome.
Yeah.
Thanks. Awesome. It's good to hear.
Yeah.
That's really good to hear. Yeah, I think Jack Frost was definitely the hardest, but also, I guess, you know, maybe most rewarding in that way, you know, because the stuff that I feel like was pretty successful, not just my own, but of Jacob's or of the team's. You know, you had this great sense of pride of, like, the accomplishment of being able to achieve some of that stuff. And then, but I think favorite, probably Poe. I don't know. Poe, because he's a little bit easier, because Jack's, like, spindly, and he's got these, and his face rig was difficult, and you know what I mean. And Poe, there was a lot of forgiveness, and you could kind of overdo some things, and he was funny, and he was really simple. Not that he was dumb, but he's just more simple. I don't know how to, you know, he's got very, you know, he is who he is, and so you can just kind of act that way, you know, with him, and that kind of simplicity is a lot of fun. A lot of fun to animate, so he was easier, at least for me.
Yeah. I think the reason I said Jack is because of what Ben mentioned, is because of how challenging it was, and I enjoy being challenged and, you know, trying to overcome those obstacles.
Yeah.
Although I didn't work on Poe, but I understand how forgiving it was because I worked on Fat Puss, and Fat Puss in Boots in Trek 4 was a lot of fun for some of those same reasons, because the shape was so easy, and you kind of really understand his character. Who he is makes sense.
Now, do you shoot reference for him?
Yeah. I didn't have a lot of shots of him walking around. I had a lot of shots of him sitting, delivering dialogue or action stuff. So for the action stuff, I researched cats online. It's not hard to find cat videos online. Even for the dialogue stuff, I shot reference
myself. Now, would you do, though, that was different for that character since he was obviously way overweight?
I didn't make any physical changes or add anything to myself. I think maybe in one shot I had him playing with his fat. I might have stuffed a pillow up my shirt.
Okay.
Play with that big tub of lard belly that he had. But that's the extent of it.
Now, how's your guys' workflow change? I know, Ben, I sent you a shot. This was sometime back, a scarecrow shot that I did.
Yes.
And talking to you guys a little bit since your work, or had done a shot for Ben Rush's Project Lucy. And so you kind of talked a little about your workflow there in regards to when you get changes, because the shot that I saw from you, it was pretty far along. And then you get changes. I'm going, what do you do there? How do you get that far where you're kind of almost polishing and then get some drastic changes and start pulling pieces out there?
Well, I think what had happened for me was that I'll just talk about how, I mean, in school for me, there was a major shift from, I did everything straight ahead when I was in school. Like when I was in college, I pretty much animated everything from the beginning to the end. I went through and did there's this supervising animator at DreamWorks named Dan Wagner. And he does like the same kind of method where he starts with like the root of the body and kind of moves it around and rotates it and all that kind of stuff. And then moves out to the limbs and that's pretty much how he animates it. And so I had started off my college career doing that kind of thing. And then I realized you could do this. People did this like stepped method. I think it was like Keith Lango, actually. I went to his blog when I was in college. And I was like, oh, you can do stepped and then you can pose it out. And because the trouble with going straight ahead, it was so hard to plan where you were going to go. And so there was a big shift there. And then when I got to DreamWorks, I kind of did that for a while. And then only, I guess, in the last couple of years, I've been a little bit more reference heavy in the sense that like I've been shooting a ton of reference just to get ideas worked out and to kind of get through my blocking pass quickly. And what happened with that scarecrow shot was that I shot a ton of reference until I found a take that I liked. And then I was like, you know what? I'm going there. You know, this is what I'm going to do. And I find, at least for me personally, I can spline out, if I've got good reference, I can pretty much spline out the body just as quickly as I could if I went through and did stepped and posed out things on twos and fours or whatever. So for me, I didn't really feel like I was wasting any time splining it out. So when you saw that first shot, it looked like it was pretty far along, and it was. But if I get notes or changes and that sort of thing, I'll just go reshoot reference for that section or whatever part needs to be changed. And then I'll kind of Frankenstein it where it's like, all right, I got this new reference. And then I pretty much go over that whole part with that new reference and then kind of meld it to what I currently have. And I know sometimes before I did it, it sounded pretty scary. Like it's a pretty scary idea. Like how can you change that really quickly? Because, you know, in stepped, you could just delete a couple of poses, put in some new ones, and then you're good to go. But I found that the more time I spent on the front end getting the reference right, I actually found that I wasn't doing a whole lot of big changes when it came to when I had actually splined stuff out. And that's kind of what we found on Jack, where really the place where I was wasting most of my time. So if I did stuff in steps, whatever time I was saving there, I was wasting later on by changing things all the time and trying to address director's notes, where I just went right ahead, got the reference right and got close to the director's notes and then went ahead and animated that. And I was already way ahead, you know, of where I would have been in the normal workflow before. So even though it's scarier up front because you're doing all this work, you know, it actually saves me time and I didn't have to do as many revisions or fixes and changes.
Working with reference has been something obviously a little bit more new to the industry as far as the heavy reliance upon it and stuff. And I've really enjoyed it here at iAnimate and learning a lot of that here. But it's a little bit difficult at times trying to get that, seeing what the body is doing and understanding that and stuff. Can either one of you guys kind of elaborate on how you started using reference, how you transitioned with it and get the essence out of it without either A, rotoscoping it or B, missing the details in there?
Yeah, well, I used to work in a way that Ben said he used to work as well, you know, with the step keys, and I never had the straight ahead method that he had said he did in school. I started in school with kind of the stepped method, the way that it was taught back from the Nine Old Men, the 2D days of, you know, finding the golden poses and then breaking down from there. And then when I started incorporating reference into my workflow more, I still use that method, and I just pulled out images from the reference, and I thought, okay, that's the golden pose from this reference shoot, or you know, here's my 5 golden poses from that shot. And then I would continue on doing breakdowns and stuff. And the more I've evolved my workflow, the more I realize I'm doing that backwards. And so what I do now is I don't think about the golden poses at all. I think about the motion and the timing of how he gets between all of these things that are happening. So I find that in reference, using reference, the actual timing of the things is way more important than the posing. And I can always go back later at the very end of the shot even and improve the posing and make a slightly cleaner silhouette or lift the head up further or whatever. But the timing needs to stay much truer to the reference in order for it to be successful. And that's why Ben and I spend so much more of our time shooting the reference and getting the reference right and not wasting our time trying to find out how you get between those golden poses or doing director notes because something just wasn't clear enough or wasn't working yet.
Yeah.
Does that make sense?
Yeah. Yeah. So do you, when you're keying out your reference, what are you looking for then? You're looking for those timing changes or?
For me, I know that Ben works in a slightly different way, more of a layered approach. I'll let him talk about that. But mine is more like keying the entire body. Every time there's a major change of direction on any body part that is essential to what I'm doing, whether it's the root or the shoulders or the head. And so you end up keying once every 3 frames to 6 frames. It's random. It's not necessarily like every 2 frames you're doing something. But and I'm keying any of those moments where there's a change in direction on a body part, and I'm keying the whole body at that moment. And then I do that for the entire shot for the whole reference clip that I have, and then I watch it. I don't watch it any time until after I've done the whole shot of just kind of data entry from the reference. And after that, then I start cleaning stuff up, changing some timing if it needs to, and, you know, pushing and pulling and being a little bit more of an animator and using artistic license. But at least I'm starting from the core of something that hopefully was working in reference.
How do you get the body working right? I've noticed sometimes when I've done that, if I've got, let's say, 30 frames and you've got 10 keys in between those, and if your hips aren't right from, we'll say, 10 and 30, then the ones in between there that you kind of started keying from those two ends can start kind of getting off. And so, you know, you adjust one end, you have to adjust kind of the ones in the middle as well. Do you find that being a problem or?
Yeah, I understand that that's going to be an issue. And that always happens. The first time I watch it back, it's like clicky and poppy all over the place because, you know, I keyed something and then I forgot about that for a few more frames and then I keyed it again later. And so it's jumping and popping and stuff. So the first thing I do when I start cleaning it up is I go into the root because that drives so many other different things. And I make sure that the curves are actually working and there's no like sharp plateaus or anything like that. And that usually gets you most of the way there. And then you have that same exact issue with any of the other body parts that it's going to be a little clicky. And so you just know that that's part of the process and you're going to have to clean it up.
Well, for me, I do it slightly differently. I think what's great about, at least for me, what makes most sense to me about doing it this way that we're talking about is that it's getting closer to the heart of I think what is key about animation or the whole point of animation. So
performance.
Yeah, the performance. And actually, it was Dave Pate, one of our supervisors, I think, who had told me this, but there's one time we were working together, I think on Kung Fu Panda 2, and he's like, you understand mechanics, you've got all this stuff down, you know, you understand thought and all this kind of stuff. He said, but you're missing something. And I think I know what you're missing. He's like, I want you to think about animation this way. I want you to think about it as, what do you want the audience to feel when they see your shot? So it was no longer about, is this performance believable? Is the movement believable? Is the timing nice? Is the posing nice? All of that kind of went out the window in terms of what I was thinking about, or what was most important. And I started looking at my reference in the way that I would watch my reference until I saw something and I was like, I believe that. So it's like I saw something and I'd have a take and I'm like, that feels like sad to me. That feels like Poe sad, or that feels like something sad. And I waited until I got that feeling, or something that was really, really close to that feeling, as close as I could get to it. And then that's the reference take that I would put in. So what's nice is you start from something that works, and then I feel like my job from there is to, and it's not as easy, I think, as saying like, oh, well, this usually indicates that emotion, or this usually indicates that. I think my whole career, I'm probably going to be doing the same thing, where I'm dissecting the movement. I'll rotoscope some parts, I'll improvise some other parts, but essentially what I'm doing is I want to extract from that reference what's giving me that feeling. And so whatever it is, you know, that is giving me that feeling, I want to try to preserve that as much as possible. So sometimes if I don't know what it is exactly, I'll be a little bit more literal to the reference and I'll copy it a little bit closer. And then from there, like what Jacob was saying, he'll manipulate poses or change things and shape things and rearrange things, timings and whatnot, to sort of emphasize it. But then, you know, making sure that all the while you're preserving that feeling, you know, that feeling stays there. And I feel like, just even as a student of animation and emotion and acting and all that kind of stuff, you start to build up this small library in your head of what gives you a feeling, you know what I mean? Or what is it about that thing? Now, you're not always going to know what it is, you know, because a lot of that stuff is kind of intangible. But if you start pretty close to your reference, sometimes you'll be able to pick up and add those things that give you the feeling and that you wouldn't have gotten normally. And
at least lays that foundation for you.
Right. It lays down that foundation so that you can then start manipulating and changing. And once you lose it, you're like, oh, I just realized that head shake that I took out, or that slight weight move, you know, the weight shift actually gave me that feeling of vulnerability or that feeling of indecision or whatever it was. And so you're like, ah, that's something that I have to keep. You know what I mean? That needs to be preserved. And I think that's a much better way to approach it, because we did a podcast with Richie Bainham, and we were actually talking about this at lunch today. But, you know, there are conflicting feelings about motion capture versus hand keyed, and really I think a lot of us just maybe feel threatened by the idea that, you know, maybe a machine is going to take over my job one day, which in some respects, yes, I can see that. But in other respects, you know, there's always going to be need for, you know, the artistry and the talent that we have. But what he said was that as long as the performance gets there on screen, I don't care how we get it, sort of thing. Or I don't care what tools we use. And I think that was right around the time when I decided that I was going to start using reference a little bit more and kind of put a lot, some of it was actually putting aside some pride where I was like, no, I'm an artist. I can design and I can create anything out of my head and it'll be believable. When I realized that there's just some stuff I'm never going to be able to create just out of my head. But I can use reference instead of a crutch. It's just a tool that I use to get the performance that I want up on screen, because ultimately that's all that matters. Nobody's going to care about what you did to create it, how long it took you to create it. All that matters is what ends up there. So if that's the ultimate goal, well, heck yeah, I'm going to take whatever tool I need. I'm going to use whatever I can. I'm going to cheat as much as I can to get that performance believable and right, you know, up on screen.
Yeah.
Right. I think Ben and I were talking a little while ago about how when we used to use far less reference, we, I don't want to say relied on, but found a lot more happy accidents in our work.
Yeah. Yeah.
And even though that spontaneity has left our work with our stronger use of successful reference, we find that our work is far more successful, far stronger for not having those happy accidents. It might have been fun on the way during the shot, but it's not as successful in delivering to the audience. You know?
Yeah, and it makes it feel like your shot has purpose. Like you could ask us about any one of our jack shots from Rise of the Guardians, and we could tell you exactly why we did some of the moves that we did. It was no longer like, well, it just felt right. It was like, you know, you feel like your work is more purposeful, and that's, I think, ultimately much more rewarding than, you know, like the happy accident route, you know? Because it feels like the happy accident, you could lose that at any point, right? You know, you could be like, I don't know how I got it or when I got it, but it somehow kind of came on, and while it is kind of fun and part of the creative process, it's scary to think that you had to rely on something like that to happen to get some nice bit of animation, whereas like, no, I know how to get these things. I know how to get a good result. You know?
Well, it kind of goes back to a little bit what we talked about at the beginning, though, that you only have so much time for a shot, you know, out of the studio. If it was your own stuff and you had plenty of time to work on it, you'd have more time for those happy accidents. Where you're at a studio that you're short on this time per se, you know, relative to your own stuff, you do have to get from point A to point B a little bit more methodical.
Yeah. Sure, it does make you more proficient, but I think it also makes you a stronger animator or a stronger storyteller because of using something that is more truthful, coming from something where the reference was working already.
Yeah. Plus, artists, we need deadlines. You just need to have deadlines. Otherwise, you're going to, you know, you'll noodle forever on the thing.
Well, one of the things I thought that made Rise of the Guardians so successful visually was the fact that I know, you know, it was obviously one of your guys' highest detailed and, for lack of a word, realistic, but it didn't feel, and I've mentioned this in some of the earlier podcasts, it didn't feel motion captured. It felt very still animated. It felt very loose in a lot of places and stuff. So I think that's kind of what you're talking about there, that you got that groundwork from the reference and maybe following it, like you said, very meticulously, but then it still gave you that freedom now to kind of push things further than what you maybe, than the reference was.
Yeah, yeah, I think you get something that works and then you just try to plus it from there. You know what I mean? You at least start with something that is solid. And I think that's what we were trying to do, you know? Were you going to say, Jacob? Were you going to say something?
No, I was just agreeing. Okay. You're right.
Of course.
Yeah. Let me see if I can throw a grenade in there to kind of mix this up a little bit. No. Now, I think I had heard, Ben, that you were used quite heavily on Rise of the Guardians for reference quite a bit. Was it just for your shots and stuff, or was it for a lot of other shots, or how did that work?
Well, for most of my shots, I used myself, as I think Jacob, you know, he used a lot of himself for his shots. But occasionally we would call each other in, especially if there's something where it's like, I just want someone else's take on this, or I want someone else to do it. And plus, I know, like, Jacob, someone else might be very successful at a different type of acting or you know, maybe being more physical or whatever it was. And so, you know, you want to grab them in. But, yeah, there were a number of times where I shot reference for other either team members or sometimes people who weren't necessarily Jack team members but had a Jack shot. I remember for Mike Stern, he had this shot where Jack Frost is in Pitch's lair, and then he falls through the shadow and falls all the way down in the lair and lands on the basement, and then backs off and gets scared and runs away. And granted, I think at the end of it, I don't know how much of my reference he used, but he certainly showed my reference in dailies. I remember that. It's funny because you're like, you go shoot reference, and then every once in a while, like, someone will show that reference, but you're like in dailies in front of everybody, and you're like, hey, I'm like, you didn't tell me you were going to show my stuff.
Surprise. Yeah.
I'm like, cool. Well, then there's me.
Yeah.
Occasionally, I mean, I think I was also kind of fortunate that Jack is like the closest character I've animated on that's been into proportionally to me. You know what I mean?
Much more so than Poe, right?
Yeah, exactly. So I think it was just fortunate in some ways. Plus, because I'd worked so closely with the character as with the rest of the Jack team, we could get to the acting choices that were more consistent with that character quicker. So it was just more efficient but it was also kind of fun. I don't know. It was a little bit fun to have someone like trust you for some reference and then to work collaboratively with people, because a lot of times people get so locked in their cubes and where they are, they don't really talk to other animators. But it was a nice chance to like hash stuff out and really talk about character, which was cool as well.
There were a few times where I was asked to shoot reference for somebody else where they just didn't care. They wanted my take, not theirs. And so I'd say, like, so what were you thinking for this shot? What do you want me to do? And they're like, I don't know. You know, Jack, do your thing.
Yeah, it's funny.
Do you like, for the most part, shooting your guys' own reference, or do you like working with other people, or how does that work?
It's always fun to collaborate. Like Ben was saying, there were a number of scenes where we shot reference together and just kept alternating who was in front of the camera to see, you know, which different things we could bring to it. For example, I know some of my shots where Jack is fusing his broken staff back together, Ben and I both shot a number of takes together of that action to see, you know, how we could sell that idea of him trying to will these two pieces of wood together to make the staff again. It was a lot of fun.
Now, how do you go about getting into your character that you're going to have to work on? We've talked about in some of the previous podcasts, kind of getting to know the character, making this a believable person. How do you, in your process, go about kind of defining that for you, this character or characters?
Well, I think at least for me, it's difficult at the very beginning of a film. Like if you ever get on a film early on when the character isn't really defined, because what happens a lot of times is you have some animators that do some shots that are very successful with a character. And for whatever reason, everybody's kind of like, oh, that's who Poe is. Or, oh yeah, that's who, you know, at least in Me and My Shadow, you know, that's who Daniel is. And so sometimes you can kind of gravitate around that and be like, okay, cool. That's kind of where the character is going. But I know on Rise of the Guardians, like, we had a lot of sessions where we got to talk to Peter, so sometimes we get informed a lot by the director of what the director wants or where the director can go. Actually, currently on Me and My Shadow, we're very fortunate that Alessandro Carloni, who's our director, is also a very good actor, and he really knows the characters very well. So we get a ton of information from him about who the character is. And watching a screening of the film, watching sequences, listening to the voice, and sometimes watching the lipstick cam. Not that we really use the lipstick cam a ton for acting reference, but sometimes, like, I think if you were to watch video reference of Gerard Butler from How to Train Your Dragon, you can see a ton of Gerard Butler and Stoic's animation. So I think it just, for me, it just comes from multiple sources until you find that, I don't even know how you find it, but at some point it's kind of like, oh, that's it. You know what I mean? Or, oh, that's the character, or that's closer, you know?
Mm. What about you, Jacob?
It's an incredibly difficult thing to talk about. In addition to what Ben said, because those are all absolutely accurate, but you do have to know the character and the character's arc throughout the whole film and how that relates to the sequence you're working in and how that sequence relates to just the shot you're working in. So yeah. The character has to be sad at that moment. You need to know if it's 100% sad or like 60% sad, and you can't go to 100% sad if he really has to be 100% sad two sequences later, because it'll ruin that effect. So you have to take that into consideration and go in stages and find the specific moment for that character. And that's always the difficult part, right? How do you become that specific moment?
Yeah. That even happened with Jack Frost a little bit in the film, where we had animated Jack a certain way. Very kind of natural, even to a certain point, kind of contained and cool, you know, pardon the pun. But he at a certain point, Jeffrey Katzenberg said that he was like too understated, or that he needed to have, you know, he needed to be pushed more. And so initially we were kind of like, I don't know, because we had put a lot of work and thought into acting, you know, animating him this specific way. But ultimately, and fortunately, we kind of animated the movie from beginning to end, so we were kind of moving towards the end of the story, so it was giving us more opportunity to give Jack a little bit more of an arc. And so we actually started to open him up a little bit more and push the shapes a little bit more and make his acting a little bit more broad. And so even over the course of a film, even when you're like halfway through or three quarters of a way through a film and you feel like you have the character pretty well narrowed down, sometimes you'll still get that outside input, and you're like, oh, there's another part to this character that we should add, or that makes them. And I think what actually is really exciting about being an animator, especially when you're working on a feature film, and I didn't really think about this before, at least not for the first couple of years I was at DreamWorks, was that you could be the person who creates a moment with a character that really helps define who they are. because there are moments in films where, like, you remember how Han Solo is for the entire film, but it's not like every shot of him is a character-defining moment. He may be in character, but it's not something that you use as, like, a tentpole of, like, this is how I understand the character. But you'll think of certain moments, you know, like that I know moment when she's like, I love you, and he's like, I know, as he goes down into the to be frozen. It's like, for me, that's, like, such a defining moment of, like, who Han Solo is. And as an animator, you have that opportunity every once in a while to be like, this could be a moment where this gives the audience that feeling of who this character is. So it's
Ben had that opportunity on Kung Fu Panda 1 because there was a Facebook group made about his shot.
I forgot about that.
It was called I Hated DreamWorks Animation Until I Saw Poe Eat the Peaches. And Ben's shot was the one where Poe has his mouth full of peaches and he's like, this is some of a peach tree, and one falls apart.
Yeah,
they had a screen grab of that, and he had
I didn't make that page. I swear I didn't make it. I don't have a friend who made it.
Self-promotion.
Yeah. You guys, check this page out.
Yeah. I saved DreamWorks. That's great.
Thanks for bringing that up again, Jacob.
Any other funny anecdotes from working on Rise of the Guardians or any other projects you guys have worked on together?
Well, let me think.
To put us on the spot.
I know it. Yeah. I know it.
Well, I mean, it's just it's hard because over the course of the film, you go through so many ups and downs. I mean, Rise of the Guardians was only because it was the more recent film, because Jack Frost was so difficult, and because he was such a character that was in the spotlight. The trials and tribulations of trying to animate him correctly and get something nice and appealing and to get something likable definitely had its ups and downs. But I'm just trying to think of, like, I mean, a fun times that we had together. Usually, most of the time, I think when we would have fun was just when we were shooting reference together or maybe just even commiserating.
Over it. Kind of down in the trenches together, brothers type of idea.
But, you know, it's true. It's kind of like, it is kind of like brothers in the trenches. I mean, you're all working towards a definitive goal. You're all working as hard as you can and relying on one another for help and support and input and actually, I think we'd find – most of the time we'd find humor just making fun of each other, I think. You know, if we'd make an acting choice that was so far off, we'd, you know, we wouldn't let the other person live it down. You know, we'd always pick it up.
Oh, timid going in to shoot more reference next time, huh?
Yeah.
How is it working on a team like this? Because I know in the past with some of the DreamWorks films – it's been kind of, I remember Jason mentioning on Monsters vs. Aliens or something like that, you were kind of on multiple different characters. Whereas it now, it seems, I think, like DreamWorks is the last couple films have been more teams. Is that about right?
It depends on the project. Yeah, but most recently, a bunch of the films have been character-based teams.
Have you enjoyed that, or do you like working on multiple different characters, or?
I think it's a lot of fun because you actually get to really know the character. And so, like, by the end of the film, I could animate a really long jack shot, like, let's say 300 times faster than someone who has never animated jack before.
Yeah.
You know, just maybe 1,000 times faster. Just more. Yeah. But just because you know which controls to use, you know how to get there sooner, you know how to make the face more appealing quicker, the shooting the reference and getting the acting choices. But I would have loved to animate some Pitch stuff or some Norse stuff. It would have been really fun to get to explore other characters too. So it's really, you know, a double-edged sword. It has its good and bad.
I think I definitely prefer working on one character. I think sometimes people don't really hit their stride on a character until like halfway through the film sometimes. And it's a shame because then the best work starts to come out then. And a lot of times that was because either you didn't have a lot of time in development or because you're animating on the film, but you're animating all these different characters and you just happen to work on this one character a little bit more than the other. But if you are on that dedicated team, you can really specialize and try to focus because every character will have different controls even. And so becoming familiar with the different controls that you use and where you stay to get the nice shapes, you just become more efficient both in your choices and in how you animate. And so that's what I kind of like about it. And plus it gives me a more definitive, it feels like to me, it gives me more definitive ownership over something when I finish a film rather than just a series of shots that I've done. It's not only chunks of shots, but owning a character and helping you know, like I was saying earlier, to get that feeling of a character. Because if people end up being like, oh, I love Jack Frost, you feel more like I helped more to contribute that, rather than, well, I did a few shots here, so did you like those shots? Or, you know?
And then they start a whole another Facebook page about that particular
shot. Yeah, of course. Yeah. It's funny because Richard's, like, it's just, for me, he's just a picture. Is that same for you guys?
I'm still here. I'm just spying on you guys.
Okay, because it's like Richard just seems like he's pleased at everything we're saying.
I am. I'm watching you guys closely, so it's everything's going great. No.
It sounds a little bit creepy, just a tiny bit.
No, honestly, this is great stuff. If you wanted, I had a really quick question, and then sure. You can go with it, Larry. Guys, you're doing fantastic. Let me just say that. Jacob, you were talking about acting skills, and I wanted to know, like, how did you improve your acting skills and improving your acting choices? Like, what did you do to grow?
Yeah, it was working with people that I respect and have better decisions than I do. And I learned from them, and now some of those decisions are mine as well. And, you know, it's kind of an amalgamation of a lot of different people's acting choices and how I interpret them, and now they're partially mine and my input is there as well. And it's that growing process of learning from people that are better than you, whether they're your supervisors or the rest of the people on your team. We had weekly meetings for the Jack team where we'd get together and show each other our reference or our shots, whatever stage they would be at, and all collaborate and talk about how to make it more Jack and how to improve the acting choices and stuff like that. And I think that helped me grow a lot.
And did you find it challenging? And I guess we'll ask Ben the same question, but did you find it challenging? I mean, at first, didn't you find, like, by letting people make better choices for you or you put in a lot of input, did you find you weren't really animating the shot, or like you didn't own the shot?
I think ultimately the shot is yours. So whatever you do in your shot is your fault, and you will be the only one to blame. So if you don't get the shot done, if you finish the shot, you know, you're going to get all the praise for it and you're going to get all the criticism for it. So if you take an idea from somewhere, you know, if you steal something or you come up with it on your own, like I said, since the performance is the most important thing and what goes up on the screen, like I said, it doesn't really matter where you get it, because it's all up to you. I mean, you're still making the decision to input that into your shot. You're still making the decision like, yes, that is a better acting choice. I should put that in. Or no, I think this is going to work better. I should do that sort of thing. And so.
Right. And your execution is still your execution.
Exactly.
Even if it's a little bit of their idea, it helps make it better, but you really executed that idea and sold it.
Yeah, absolutely.
I don't think I've ever struggled with the ownership idea in those terms. One of the biggest helps for me with learning better acting was my supervisor, Dave Pate, on Jack Frost. And the very first time I ever shot reference with him, Ben was in the room too, but halfway through the take, he'd be like, no, do it again. And half the time, I didn't really know what the difference was. And then it's when I started to study the tapes, I realized what he was helping me get to. And that those little light bulb moments kind of guide your way throughout the rest of the film.
What were some of the things that he was trying to guide you towards?
I just wasn't really in the moment of the character. And I was thinking about, like, I need to do this, then I need to do that, then I need to do this. Instead of, he would guide me to, like, imagine this is actually happening in front of you and find a place to look on the ceiling instead of just pretending to look around. You actually have to look at something. You could see the difference clearly in the reference and the difference comparing takes.
Dave would do something similar with me where I would be listening to an audio take over and over again, and I would be doing reference to that audio take. But what was happening a lot of times is I was trying to time myself up. I was worried too much, even though you don't realize it consciously, but you're trying your best to time up to that audio. And that will force acting. Like, that will force certain things to try to happen sooner or later. And there was one time where he was like, turn off the audio, just shoot it at your own pace. You kind of know the idea of what the line is. Just, I'm going to turn off the audio, we're just going to shoot it, and you just shoot it, you know, at your own pace. Don't worry about trying to catch up or speed up or slow down or whatever.
Just act it out.
Just act it out. And that was one of the things that was most freeing that kind of helped me get maybe more on track with what the, you know, in the mode of the character or trying to think about what the character would do or how to sincerely feel something. Like I did a series of shots of Jack on the rooftop talking to the moon in Rise of the Guardians. And one of the things Dave told me was something sort of similar to Jacob, where, you know, you need something to look at. Because a lot of times I would just kind of be looking up at the ceiling. But, you know, Jack's looking up at the moon. So, yeah, I would actually have a picture up, you know, of someone. And I would have it up on the wall. And I would sit there I had a hockey stick. That's what I was using for the cane. And I would hold on to it and I'd look up at the picture. And I knew the whole line. And then I would just sit and wait until the feeling started to come over me of what Jack was feeling on the rooftop. Like, trying to make sure I'm not going to rush myself. I've got plenty of time booked in the reference room. I'm not going to rush myself. I'm just going to sit there and I'm not going to force any line of dialogue. When I'm ready to go, I just go, sort of thing. And that kind of stuff, like certain little tips, I don't know if I would have gotten that stuff on my own, but, you know, like, yeah, you'll have, you know, a supervisor or someone that you know that does a really good job. Like, you'll see it in their animation. Like, you'll see in the animation unique, fun, believable acting choices, and you'll be like, I bet that person either shoots reference or they know what they're talking about. So, like, you'll go talk to them and you get some ideas and that sort of thing. And so you do, at least for me, that helped me to become a better animator. Plus, you know, just even having discussions about acting with other animators, being like, oh, yeah, did you see so-and-so's performance in this movie? Did you like it? Did you not like it? You know, it doesn't have to be in depth. It can just be something as simple as, like, I didn't like it. And then you can even just start to talk about why you didn't like it. And I think if the more you can start to get your brain around those ideas and thinking in that way and observing in that way, where you're actually analyzing performances in the sense that, do I believe what that character is doing or saying? Hopefully not to the extent where it'll ruin stuff for you. You can become so analytical that you're like, you know, I can't watch any performance.
You just can't have fun anymore.
Yeah, exactly.
I have another anecdote of a way to get more into the character and the right emotion for the scene was that I had a really quick shot of Jack. After Jack and Bunny are kind of going at it and they're antagonizing each other, and Tooth defends Jack and says, you know, Bunny, cut it out. Jack quickly says, no, the kangaroo's right. And so it's another little, like, jab. And I kept shooting reference of that and saying, no, the kangaroo's right. And every time I showed it to Dave, he would say, like, it's very clear you're just trying to get the line out. You're saying the words, and it's all about the words. It's not about the emotion underneath. So just say the subtext. Go in there and say, well, I'll, you know, censor this since I'm sure it's a family-friendly show. But I went in there and said, jerk face is right. Instead of the kangaroo's right. And that actually helped deliver the right emotion in my body language and the timing of my head movements and on the face and everything. And then I just switched out the lip sync.
Nice.
Actually, I think that's a really good trick. I think I've done that. I've done that a couple of times myself, where if I can't get the emotion right, I just go down to the subtext of, like, what was it? I had someone who was doing, like, a pantomime, and it was just a pantomime, no lip sync. And I was like, well, then do this. And I sat down and I was like, oh, okay, where's that letter? Where's that letter? Where's that? Ah, yeah, here it is. Okay, perfect. Okay, what the f***? And then you start to go on and on and whatever, and you get really into it, and it's like, even though
I censored myself.
I know.
Sorry.
I'll have to censor you after, don't worry.
What the bleep? But you're going through it, but it helps to, like Jacob was saying, like, because our whole job is to, what is it? It's the external expression of an inward reality. That's the whole idea of acting, where you could do something that's very believable, because my version of depressed might be very true to who I am, but it might not communicate depressed very well to someone who's watching me. And while it might be very believable and true, since it doesn't communicate very well, it's not very good acting. And that's the whole role as an actor or an animator, is that you need to get that emotion, but show it or get the audience to feel it. I think that's a lot of times where that's that hard line to find, that believable, that's not over the top, but still portrays the emotion.
Is there any types of shots that you guys gravitate more towards that you enjoy more? We asked Tal this and he's like, man, I get the funny shots. He goes, but I'm not funny, you know? But is there any shots that you guys, that you really go, hey, if I can get a chance to work on that one, that's the one I want to work on?
I think Ben and I both got a lot of the really meaty acting stuff for this film. And I think now on the films we're currently working on, we're trying to get a little bit more of the funny stuff just to broaden our vocabulary.
do you gravitate towards that, or is it just because you want to expand yourself as an artist?
Towards the funny ones now.
Yeah. Do you like a mixture of everything, a buffet, or is it there's stuff that you kind of you're just more comfortable with, and that you're wanting to try different stuff just to kind of get out of that comfort zone? Or
yeah, I don't like being comfortable. I think that's a lot of it. And after Guardians, I did become pretty comfortable with really close up, intimate acting moments. And so now I'm forcing myself to be uncomfortable and try something that I am not confident in.
I think naturally I am more inclined to want to do more subtle or natural kind of animation. But that's the nice thing about now moving on to another project that we can express in a different way, you know, be more cartoony and open with it, which is awesome as well. But I know that's a lot less in my wheelhouse than maybe more natural acting would be. At least I think, you know, at least in terms of stuff that I feel most comfortable with, you know.
Well, just, I'm sure you guys already talked about it, but I just want to make sure I get it and the audience get it. Do you prefer to think what the character is doing or trying to get the right moment or the motion right? Or do you prefer to try to be the character when you're planning out your acting scene?
I think it requires a healthy dose of both. You have to do the thinking and understand where the character's at before you can even begin to try to be the character in that moment.
I agree. I'm only thinking about one thing ultimately, and that is, you know, what is the character feeling, and how to, you know, how do you get that, just getting a believable performance across and my reference as closely, you know, as closely as I can is really the only thing I'm concerned about. And almost, I guess, maybe to my detriment sometimes, because sometimes I throw away the principles so much. I remember on a shot or two, I almost left just even some basic ideas of like what would be interesting timing in the shot out so far that I did the shot and I was like, I thought it was believable, but as I was watching it, I was like, it's a little bit boring. So sometimes there's stuff needs to be interjected in, but I mean, I would much rather have that problem than, you know, the opposite. You know what I mean?
Trying to be like, okay, this needs some overlap, and then backtrack and figure out how to get some emotion into the overlap.
Right. Right. I would much rather be, Milk Call was amazing, so I can't really knock him on anything, but I would much rather be a Frank Thomas than a Milk Call, if that makes sense. I'd rather be working harder to get a beautiful drawing, but I've got the acting right, than always having beautiful drawings and maybe sacrificing some of the acting for those prettier drawings and prettier movement. Hmm. Again, not to knock Milk Call. I'm not sure.
No.
Too amazing. Milk Call hater.
Yeah, I know.
You're so going down. You're such a dead man.
That's the next animation god somewhere.
Okay, a couple more here. What are some of the things that you guys enjoy doing outside of animation that kind of keeps you active and busy and your mind on something else, maybe another passion or whatever?
There's not a lot of time for much else. We're both fairly newly married. We both run the blog outside of work, and we both teach outside of work. So that takes up a lot of time. I guess the only other thing that I could say is I watch a lot of TV and a lot of movies in the name of research.
Yeah.
And I really enjoy rigging and mel scripting as kind of an aside to, you know, it's just a slight tangent to animating, but I feel like it exercises a different part of my problem solving brain, which keeps me fresh. I like, you know, having an artistic side and the scripting
logical
side. Yeah, logical rigging type problem solving thing.
Okay. What about you, Ben?
For me, it's much more, I play hockey and soccer are kind of my main, and I play video games. So I guess those are my more like, because for me, it's harder, it's hard for me to come home and try to animate or come home or do actually anything on the computer besides answer emails. But even sometimes answering emails can, it's like I'm back in front of a screen again. So usually whatever I do, I mean, I know video games is in front of the TV, but at least I'm not like right up front in front of a monitor, or it's something that I can just kind of relax and do. But for the most part, yeah, it's usually like hockey or soccer or running or something to get me up and out.
So what kind of games do you like playing?
Well, currently I'm playing Far Cry 3, which I'm really enjoying.
Did you catch our podcast with Daryl Purdy?
No, I didn't, but I need to. I think Jamal told me about it, or someone told me about it. No, I have to check that out. Yeah, I played Far Cry 3. I have a whole backlog of games that I haven't finished. Like, I haven't finished Arkham Asylum, which I feel really bad about. I love that game. Skyrim, I had to drop just because it was sucking every last minute of my free life. And Halo 4, I always play on, like, Wednesday nights with some other buddies from work. So that will always be in the stable.
Now, what are you enjoying about teaching here at iAnimate, Jacob? You've been here with us now. This is our eighth block, so.
Wow.
Yeah. I know. You're a soldier now.
goes by fast. I love seeing the moment where it kind of clicks for some people, that especially in the early stages, because, you know, Ben and I are so big with the reference that I try and push that onto the students. Ask any of my students and they'll tell you how you know, demanding I am with the reference, but it really helps give them a better performance. And a lot of times the first take they give me, or the first couple takes, are really non-specific and bland, and I try to guide them to a place where they can find the specificity of that moment. And for them to submit the next week and show me something that suddenly is really entertaining because of the specifics, it's just like, yes, got it. And that's really rewarding. I love that part of it.
What do you find it most difficult about teaching?
Everything else. it's a challenge. It really is. I think something that's good and bad about it is that it makes me analyze myself, because people ask me, why'd you do that? And I'd be like, I have no idea. Why don't I try and figure out why I did that? And then that, it's really hard to do, but it helps me learn a little bit more about my process, and probably helps me be better at my own work too, because I know why I'm making decisions
better. Well, we really do appreciate your guys' time. Hope you guys have a great new year here, 2013. This is our first podcast, so I think we're going to go out with a bang with you guys here. So really. Awesome.
Excellent. Thank you so much for having us.
Well, thank you, Larry. Thank you, Rich.
Absolutely.
Yeah, guys, it was awesome. I have so many notes I wrote down here. Even personally, I just love hearing you guys talk about animation and sharing it.
Rick's listening to the podcast live now, so he won't even need the recording. He's just sitting back listening. Awesome. And appreciate you guys, what you're doing with the speaking of animation, so keep that rolling too.
Oh, yeah. Great, thanks for the plug.
We do need to post more. I know
there was a hiatus there for a while. I was like, guys, what's the deal?
A lot of that was Guardians, I think.
That was Guardians.
Okay. Well, yeah. So give the website real quick.
Speakingofanimation.com.
All right. We'll put it in our notes there. Yeah, if you can't remember that, I don't know how you even got on the internet. So it should be pretty easy. All right, guys. Thanks again for your time. You guys have a good night.
Awesome. You too. Thank you, Larry.
Good night, guys.
See you guys. Bye.